I've been born and raised in Germany as a child to parents from former Yugoslavia. Even as a child, to me, my hometown in Germany was a landlocked concrete jungle. There was, and still is, at least for what I perceive as my needs, limited access to natural environments, or let's say, relatively untouched or remote environments. Effectively, there is no access to them unless you travel quite far. It's also very difficult to put your feet on anything but concrete. And to me, even city parks never did the trick, given their cultured existence. Equally difficult, it seems like you can only ever see the sky in stripes and squares as you look up through rows of multi-story buildings and high-rises. It seems as though this experience engendered a deep longing for more natural environments in me, and with that, an urge to travel and reach remote places. Fully aware of my privilege in this regard, as well as quite painfully its environmental paradox, I've been fortunate enough to do a fair bit of traveling until today, and have been to, for me, as far away places as the Yukon, Alaska, and Iceland. Until not too long ago, I also lived in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and reveled in the immersion in sea, forests, and mountains that daily life affords there. I've climbed mountaintops, kayaked with whales, touched glaciers, and camped in fjords. And during my last few years of living there, I had the immense privilege and fortune of waking up to the sight of the sea. For about the last year now, I've been living in Norway. I have to pinch myself on a daily, but so far, this has been mostly on a peninsula in the middle of a fjord. I live in a rather small house, but it is surrounded by trees, and quite unexpectedly for me, this spring through autumn, I've benefited from wild growing berries of all sorts, deers and badgers visiting the garden, birds chirping every morning, and to be fair, also during the night with the never-ceasing sunlight of the summer. The beach, if you welcome the colder water, is also just a few minutes away, and the deep green of the water has something special to it that I've never experienced before. All that said, my mother, for example, still lives in my hometown in Germany, and has, over the years, experienced increasingly hot temperatures during summers. Beyond 35 degrees Celsius seems the new normal now, and I know it wears on her. As a child, I remember snow falling in the city in the winter, quite plentifully, and also staying around, at least for a while. But now you'd be hard-pressed to experience that. It might snow here and there, but not so often, and it certainly won't stay around. Where I've lived in Norway through this last year, it was really magical to see and feel snow again this past winter. It's somewhat common in the mountainous areas of New Zealand, particularly on the South Island, but it only ever snowed once and very briefly where I lived for those 11 years there. Speaking of the snow and winter here in Norway, however, it seems that this winter was amongst the first where people here really felt a big change, with there being far less snow than people are used to and looking forward to engage in their winter sports endeavors. You might say it was a mild winter and a rather warm summer, but in reality, they have been maybe moderately worrying rather than mild. The first time I went to New Zealand, a decade prior to moving there, I also remember visiting a glacier and hearing stories about how much it had already receded over the years. I've never gone back to that glacier, and I must admit, this is at least in parts because I did not want to deal with the sadness and dread I would feel by seeing it having receded even further than that. Standing at the edge of a glacier, there is something distinctly more about melting than there is about ice and deep time when we encounter a glacier today, and knowing what we know today. There's a small chance that I might be moving further north within Norway in the not too distant future, following the call of a new job. This is a strange thing for me to consider, but on the one hand, I'm extremely excited about this prospect, and on the other, I'm so worried and scared of the changes I will witness there throughout my time. Already now, the Arctic is warming two to four times the rate of the rest of the world. Permafrost is melting, Arctic sea ice is disappearing at dramatic rates, and microplastics have been found in the snow falling there. It's hard to even think about, and to be honest, my chest feels like it's constricting, affecting both heart and lungs. Frankly, I don't know what to do. My name is Philip Marich, and I will be guiding you through this podcast. Across 8 short sections, my hope is for us to circle through a range of topics relevant to what we might consider environmental physiotherapy education, if there is such a thing. I would like to invite you to use the pause between each section and note down a reflection or two. You can then bring all of them or just your most pressing one to the Canvas Padlet for this conference stream so that we can talk and think more together. If possible, with this first section, I would like to invite you to go outside, walk through and reflect on the place you're from or the place you live at now. If you cannot go outside, you can of course journey through these environments in your mind. Describe the natural environment in which you live, and then describe what environmental changes you have observed in your own life, or maybe your family has observed in their own lifetime. How do these changes make you feel? To be clear, I'm very aware of the fact that these personal experiences of the natural environments around us will be vastly different depending on a range of factors, where we live, our socioeconomic kind of situation, and a few other issues. There's no question that this needs acknowledging and reflecting on. But what I'm interested in here is our personal experiences of the natural environment and the changes we have seen in our own lifetime. I'm inclined to think there will be something available to all of us in this regard, no matter where we are. I'll leave you to it. Global warming is highly likely to exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement a few years ago. We're more likely heading towards 4 degrees Celsius on current emissions trajectories. Greenhouse gas emissions have doubled since the 1980s alone. And current estimates are that climate change drives around 250,000 human deaths per year. Populations of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians have, on average, declined by 60% between 1970 and 2014. Currently, we're threatening another 1 million species with extinction. 40% of amphibian species and a third of marine mammals, as well as 400,000 insect species. In fact, it is projected that insects could vanish altogether within this century at the current rate of decline. We have also lost about 50% of shallow water corals in the past 30 years. Urban areas are doubling since 1992, with low-density suburbs posing particular environmental pressures by impinging on natural environments and requiring greater resource use to be serviced. 100 million hectares of tropical forest have been cut down since 1980 to 2000 alone. This was mainly for agriculture and energy use. And then another 2.3 million square meters of primary forest have been cut down since then, nearly the equivalent of Greenland. A fifth of the Amazon has disappeared in just 50 years due to deforestation. One third of the planet's land is devoted to livestock, as well as 75% of all fresh water. 70% of all farming is related to meat production. 31% of infectious disease outbreaks are directly linked to deforestation, with COVID-19 in the mix there as well. Air pollution is now the leading cause of COPDs, and kills an estimate of 7 million people worldwide every year, with 9 out of 10 people breathing air that contains high-level pollutants. Water pollution sickens about 1 billion people every year, transmitting diseases like diarrhea, cholera, dysentery, and typhoid. Plastic pollution has increased tenfold since 1980 alone. Microplastics are now detectable in Arctic snow, in rain over the USA, and in every ocean, including all of its deepest areas. Chemical pollution is also rampant. 300 to 400 million tons of heavy metals, toxic and other industrial waste, are dumped annually into world's waters. 400 dead ocean zones exist already, resulting from fertilizers entering coastal ecosystems, and leaving only 3% of ocean now considered free from human influence. According to the WHO, the burden of disease attributable to environmental problems amounts to 13 million deaths each year. That is one quarter of all deaths. More specific health impacts include dramatic increases in non-communicable diseases, respiratory and cardiovascular amongst them, heat stress, malnutrition, obesity, infectious and vector-borne disease, trauma and injury, climate migration, displacement and conflict, and associated mental health problems. These are just some of the hard facts around the ecological crisis we are facing. It seems as though we have lost sight of these a little bit due to the current COVID-19 pandemic, which is a little bit worrying in itself, because in fact, the COVID-19 pandemic is also a result of much of deforestation and human relationships to, let's say, wildlife, broadly speaking. Maybe even more so to prevent such neglect, these hard facts must inevitably become part of any socio-ecological healthcare education. What interests me, however, is the question of whether they're really the best starting point or not. This is maybe an oversimplification, but I would argue that we generally have a tendency to begin with the hard facts in physiotherapy, to use anatomy, physiology, and pathology as our anchoring points, for example. Engaging with the hard facts around a dire environmental crisis affords some interesting possibilities that might lead to different ways of thinking our way into physiotherapy or teaching physiotherapy. To start with the question, how do the hard facts of climate change, biodiversity loss, and environmental degradation make us feel? Do they get us excited or motivated to act? Or do they induce fear, overwhelm, and maybe a resistance and unwillingness to engage? The way I'm asking these questions undoubtedly reveals my own biases, but there is some evidence to suggest that our emotional responses to the hard facts are likely not on the positive side. I suppose the possibility that I wanted to explore here, by contrasting an introductory section on personal experiences of natural environments and environmental change with a section on the hard facts surrounding the latter, is whether starting from the lived personal experience might be a warmer, maybe more humane, or maybe emotionally relatable, or just somehow better starting point for environmental physiotherapy education. Does teaching through lived experience and emotion associated with difficult topics like climate change and environmental degradation present an interesting alternative experiential approach? Does it reduce resistance to dealing with these issues? Does it make us more open to considering them and learning about our potential role in meeting them? I'm wondering whether environmental physiotherapy might be a really specifically great place to try such alternative routes. If so, I'm inclined this could be really fruitful for other subject areas of physiotherapy education as well, and actually also patient education, this kind of starting from the personal and the experiential. Going back to the idea of environmental physiotherapy education more specifically, the point has also been made that reconnecting to nature is a critical element of all ecological education. And the way I opened the previous section, I've taken loose inspiration from indigenous traditions in which any introduction of oneself must include an introduction of the place one lives in as part of oneself. As an exercise, it is a conscious attempt to reconnect oneself with the land one lives on and lives off. As a praxis, it is an expression of this deep connection between person, people, land, and sea. And this way, it is also another pointer towards the idea to begin with the personal. I'll leave it here and look forward to further discussing the interweaving of personal experience and hard facts or evidence in environmental physiotherapy education with you and other elements of this activity stream. Okay, hey Sean, it's really always a pleasure to catch up with you. So I'm happy we get a chance to talk again. You're a physiotherapist.
Me too.
And contract academic working at McGill University in Montreal. And you've been researching in global health and disability. I know that you're also curating a podcast for this year's UnConference, looking at the decolonization of physiotherapy curricula. So let's dive straight into it. I know you're aware of the ecological degradation we are seeing today, as well as its diverse health impacts. Through your own work in global health, have you seen or experienced any kind of specific examples of ecological devastation and how they affect people's health, as well as maybe the ability to access health services?
I have seen some very specific examples, and I will share two with you. The first comes from the years that I was working in Haiti developing rehabilitation services. And this small country in the Caribbean has been hammered by a higher frequency and more powerful hurricanes in the last few years. So on every hurricane season, there will be a few storms that cause a lot of damage and destruction, including affecting the provision of health services. Another situation that I've seen is in my ongoing work in Western Zambia, where the Lozi people live according to the Barotse floodplains. And in that area, the floods have become more irregular. That has affected people's food supply, their ability to travel. And in both of these cases, in Zambia and Haiti, the health systems are fragile to start with. So these additional insults cause great difficulties for people to maintain their health and then to access healthcare when they need it.
Interesting, thank you. So if we apply a kind of medical lens to this problem, I know this is maybe a big and difficult question, but where would you say we should look for something like the causes, both of these health impacts, but also the environmental issues that sort of contribute to the health impacts, as well as the difficulty to access health services in such, you know, under such circumstances?
That is such a great question. And I find it really useful for us to think of this as physiotherapists, drawing upon the social determinants of health that operate at multiple levels. The two examples I gave are from my work outside of Canada, particularly in two countries that were formerly under European colonial regimes. And it's not hard to draw a line between those experiences of colonization and the current socioeconomic statuses of the country. Haiti has now been independent since 1804, Zambia for the last 50 years. But nonetheless, neither country has complete control of its economy. They were impoverished by the current situation. And then this problem is compounded by the climate crisis and other environmental issues, largely influenced by the practices of the rich countries of the global north. So there are a lot of underlying factors that then lead downstream to the health systems in which we might practice as physiotherapists. So I'm interested in talking and thinking about all those levels and hope that we as a profession have an influence at all those levels.
Thank you. Yeah, it's something that I'm reminded of is that, you know, normally current climate change is very much sort of associated to the Industrial Revolution, and sort of some assumption is there that that's when it started or something like that. But really, in the view of many historians, industrialization and fossil fuel use have only been made possible through colonization of the Americas, you know, European colonization of the Americas, and then the extraction of resources from there in order to drive European industrialization. So I think it's really kind of like important at that level to identify colonialism, but also the racism that inevitably comes with, and also a sort of its socially and environmentally extractivist practices as kind of at the root of most of these like social, environmental, and health problems at the same time. Does that resonate with you?
I agree with every point that you've brought up resonates with me. And on top of that, I will bring forth the global capitalist regime that came into effect, that became a worldwide phenomenon through European colonialism originally, and then with ongoing imperial regimes that are not always European, like we think of the influence of China, for example. But nonetheless, ways in which we interact at a global level that have been marked by colonialism are highly influential at our situation today.
Yeah, thank you. Good point. So if we move on from here a little bit, you know, I know we're moving fast through a bunch of very big issues, but I would say that teaching about, say, colonialism, racism, extractivism, and the like, and capitalism, as you mentioned, is in itself a very new and fringe kind of subject matter in physiotherapy education.
It is.
So on the one hand, there's a challenge in terms of content, in terms of what to teach, in the sense that we just haven't traditionally thought about how all these things relate to human health and function and drive today's environmental problems. But on the other hand, there's also this structural challenge in the way that we have to understand that all of these things also carry forward in our own thoughts and our knowledge systems, our clinical practices, but also our approaches to teaching, right, to education practice and curricula. So there's this additional challenge of not just having to teach something new, but also making sure that this new thing that we teach in some ways changes how we teach. So there's all of these different levels here. Again, it's a very big question, but do you have any thoughts on how we might meet these challenges in terms of integrating all this into our physiotherapy education programs?
By making a commitment to it. That you've identified that there is an enormous challenge that entails fundamental differences in the way that we think with respect to our epistemology, with respect to our practices of circulating knowledge, of sharing knowledge, of pedagogy, all of these things. And then according to the substance, there's a lot to it. So by taking an interest in this, by learning about it and making a commitment to do better, that's the one short answer that I can give that I think is up to task.
Yeah, thank you. That makes good sense. So I suppose I've had a bunch of, you know, reflections. There's a lot to think about here, but I think in terms of how to get into this for me, I think the first step that's really important is to really actively try and learn about how all these things connect, you know, how do health issues connect to social issues, connect to environmental issues, and so on. So I suppose that, to listeners, my first recommendation is, you know, to try and look for those, actively seek out those intersections. And then, you know, if we seek those out and we bring this new content into our teaching, you know, we really have to, it really does something, you know. So for example, if we teach that COPD is caused by air pollution, and air pollution, you know, happens more in particular parts of the world, due to a whole number of reasons, you know, teaching about these connections, it really does something, I think, to what we teach. You know, it really, I think, it fundamentally changes it.
Absolutely.
So I suppose my most challenging thoughts in regards to what you've been talking about is that, well, if we identify things like colonialism and racism and capitalism and so on to be at the root of our current environmental crises, as well as some of our health crises, like on what grounds do we justify to keep teaching, let's say, exhalation therapy for COPD or something, rather than, you know, to go and do something about those causes as a kind of preventative measure for, you know, for these things not happening so much in the first place? That's a big task, but I kind of find it quite exciting.
And I agree with you. I often think of the core of what we are as physiotherapists and how, if we're actively thinking about this, that it will change our approaches, both to the substance and the pedagogy. So I'm excited to talk about this more.
Cool. Thank you very much, Sean. That was great. Hi, Cleona. It's really great to talk to you again. So you're a physiotherapist by trade, and you've worked clinically for about 10 years across the UK, Scotland, and also in West Africa. You're a lecturer at the University College of Dublin for the last 13 years. And I know you've been really interested in global health and international health and development. So in our recent conversation, we've had a little talk about the UN Sustainable Development Goals and the possibility of integrating them into health professional or specifically physiotherapist education. Before we dive into specifics, can you just briefly say what the SDGs are, just for those that maybe haven't heard so much about them?
Yeah, of course, Philippe, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. I suppose to me, there's 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And to me, to put it simply, it's really about, goals that we can all do collectively at international level, at institutional level, at individual level to, I suppose, eradicate poverty, to put it in one line. And you know, we hear the phrase leave no one behind used a lot in conversations about the SDGs. And to me, that's very important. And what that means, I suppose, is that we understand and recognize and tackle inequities across education, health, social protection, and the environment. So yeah, that's to me what they mean. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Thank you. That's some huge goals and lots to strive towards, which is great. So if we go a little bit more into specifics, you said there are 17 different goals. I know that one of them is SDG 3 is about good health and well-being for all, something along those lines in terms of phrasing. So could you give me a brief example of how one could go about integrating, say, SDG 3 into physiotherapy education?
Yeah, so this is something that we do on our curriculum, and we have a core module called Health and Global Society, and this is underpinned by the SDGs. I think one of the important things is that we all get the chance to be aware of them and to make meaning of them. And for me, we do that at the beginning of a module where we look at what the SDGs are. And although we focus on SDG 3, which is the health goal or the goal that strives for good health and well-being for all at all ages, it's also about opening up all of our awareness to all of the other goals, because nothing happens in isolation. So the SDGs are really about that interaction between health, education, social protection, the environment, climate change. So how we do it is we do it in two ways, I guess. We do it very informally, where we get students looking, for example, in terms of the health goal, looking at social determinants of health and basic flip charts and whiteboards, and giving students the space to throw their own ideas, learn from each other, and I learn a huge amount from them as well. And we also take an opportunity to work with through partners that we have in Uganda, with a physiotherapy school there in Barara University of Science and Technology, where towards the end of the module, we get both sets of students to work together to co-create some resources on some of the major global health burdens like road traffic accidents or stroke or diabetes. And yes, they produce really good stuff, but what's also really interesting is that they learn from each other, and they learn about a different context and a different perspective, and how, you know, the two different environments, for example, Ireland and Uganda, how they're different, how the burden of disease is different, how the education system is different, how the law is different, and they do that in an organic way. I don't control it. They lead that themselves, and I guess from my point of view, that leads to partnership, understanding, intercultural competence, etc.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I like what you said about sort of this, the SDGs being about interactions, and maybe we can piggyback off that. And so in that way, could we maybe go to one of the sort of less obvious examples of the SDGs that less obvious to healthcare professionals, maybe, that's more explicitly tied to environmental issues, something like SDG 13 on climate action, or 14 on life below water, or 15 on life on land. And is there possibilities to maybe look at SDGs that are sort of initially feel like outside of our expertise, but nonetheless integrate them into education as well? Like into physiotherapy education? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's actually crucial, isn't it? I'm not an environmental specialist yet. I think that we all need to get comfortable in order to with environmental issues and climate change issues. It has a huge impact on health, and we know that. And I think, you know, the spirit of the SDGs is that we don't silo ourselves to just the healthcare, because I'm a health professional, or education, because I'm a teacher. The spirit of them is that actually to reach the ultimate goal of eradicating poverty is that we all need to get comfortable with all the different issues that are out there, whether it's gender inequality, whether it's climate change, all of those issues. So yeah, I think it's crucial. And I think, you know, the challenge for us as educators is finding the time, you know, and the space in our curriculum. But I strongly believe we have to do that. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. Thank you. That's brilliant. So much to think about here, and yeah, different things and interactions to consider. I suppose from my perspective, in some ways, it's for listeners of us here now, you know, as well as always for myself also, you know, how to proceed if we want to think and work with the SDGs more. To me, it's starting up by reading up about the SDGs a little bit on, for example, starting from the official UN website, which is where they come from in a way. The link to that is provided in the podcast description. But then also maybe as a kind of challenge to really reflect on one of those not so obvious SDGs apart from SDG 3, and think about how this relates across environmental issues, social issues, and our own area of expertise in teaching. And, you know, if we do a little bit of that, I think there's like some really, really fertile grounds there for future physiotherapy. Thank you so much, Cleona. That was great.
Thanks, Philippe. Nice to speak to you.
In the last two conversations with Dr. Sean Cleaver and Dr. Cleona O'Sullivan, we have touched on a variety of issues that intersect with environmental problems and their health impacts, from colonialism, racism, extractivism, to poverty and hunger. We also touched on the twofold potential that is implicit in these intersections. The first of these is that whatever we do or teach in the realm of healthcare is inherently related to social and environmental questions, and has direct and indirect consequences at the level of society and environment. And these in turn reflect back on human health and function and well-being. The first task here is what we suggested as a reflection also in the last two conversations, namely the active searching for and recognition of these intersections in everything we do or teach. I think that developing the socio-ecological awareness is a really critical fundamental point. And where it becomes a praxis embodied or enacted by a teacher, it can also become a praxis that can be emulated by students and is a really fundamental tool for helping them and us become deliberate global citizens and healthcare professionals. The second implication of the intersections is that there are multiple, if not infinite, entry points for action, which gives us great choice and freedom with regard to where we wish to enter on our own and our students' socio-ecological healthcare education. To me, particularly the second implication relates to a very important point that also links the preceding two conversations to the opening ideas on our personal experience and the hard facts around today's environmental crises. Specifically, I think that the way out of overwhelm is to identify a space of action where we feel comfortable-ish, meaning a place where we recognize intersections, where there is a challenge in what needs doing, but where we feel capable enough to take this challenge on. Put differently, there's an argument that symptoms of ecological grief, anxiety, or overwhelm might be alleviated precisely through actions aimed at reducing the underlying threat and supporting and enhancing environmental, physical, and mental health in conjunction. This means that consciously choosing and engaging in active transport, spending time in nature, engaging in community garden or tree planting projects, litter picking, protest marching, taking patients outdoors to engage in exercise, reducing waste production and energy use in teaching and clinical practice, shifting policies, changing professional responsibilities to integrate environmental ones, and so on and so on. All of these actions, knowing what one can do and acting on it, can be helpful to reduce a potentially debilitating overwhelm and meaningfully shift towards something possibly more positive and contributive. There is also a link here to the idea that, at least as far as research in this space goes so far, positive motivators like a focus on capacity, connection, future orientation appear to be more effective in the production of positive socio-environmental transformations than negative ones, like guilt, shame, sorrow, or fear. So along these lines, building on a recognition of the multitude of actions we can take presents a hopeful starting point for our pathways to education and our own actions. There is one other issue that's strongly in contrast to this, but regularly makes me wonder if positivity, hope, and action are really all there is or should be. If we're thinking specifically in the realm of today's environmental crises, species extinction, for example, has already happened and will continue to happen even in the best case scenario. The same is true for global warming and a range of other issues. And this is also why we're not just talking about mitigation, but also adaptation. But even adaptation and maybe related concepts like resilience express and still hold on to hope and capacity and all of these kind of positive and actionist notions and emotions. What I sometimes wonder, though, is whether our quickness to action, to doing something, actually disables us from considering other possibilities. I would argue that we have a deep-seated tendency in physiotherapy to rush to actions and solutions. It's really a kind of actionism. We want to know what we can do and we want to do stuff. But to what extent does that preclude us from truly going into and engaging with grief and, in a sense, the palliative aspects of health and sickness and maybe also care? How often do we allow us as physiotherapists, and so in that way also our students and patients, to sit with the loss of one thing or another, one capacity or faculty or another? What do we teach students about grief? How often do we teach our students that it is okay to just sit with something and grieve, rather than do this, that, or another to change it? And then how does that trickle down into clinical practice? This is all maybe a curious tangent, but I do wonder if maybe precisely environmental physiotherapy education, because of the immense losses it must acknowledge and engage with, might be the prime space for deepening our exploration and maybe teaching of these extremely difficult problems and emotions. Hi, Adriana. Thank you for your time. It's so great to talk to you. I know that you teach at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul in the south of Brazil, and you have a particular interest in critical perspectives, anthropology of the body and health, qualitative research, and chronic pain. I also know that you teach several subjects in the physiotherapy program at your university, and one of them is called Embodiment, Health, and Education. So you told me that in this course, you have a class in the Botanical Garden of Porto Alegre City that I'm really excited to talk to you about. Can you tell me a little bit more about this course? You know, what kind of course is this and what you do there?
Hi, Philip. Thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about this class. This is a first year discipline where I try to work with students on different ways of thinking about body, health, and education, and give them practical activities every week, which involves games, dances, exercises, meditation, and outdoor activities. Our campus is very close to the Botanical Garden of the city, a place with a silent and open space, small lakes and regional trees. So some years ago, I decided in the middle of the semester to give a class there. The student loved the experience, and I incorporated this activity in my discipline every year. It is always a good experience for the students and for me too. At the beginning of the day, we start with them walking around in small groups or by themselves. They are suggested to do it in silence, observing the birds, lakes, and trees. Then we joined the groups together to work with an invited professor from the dance course who works with the culture of native Brazilians.
That sounds so interesting and like so much fun. I'm really wishing I was your student. Can you tell me a little bit about the learning objectives for this course? Like what are the aims there in terms of learning objectives?
In this class, we have many objectives, but for me, three are special. The first is to make them connect with nature and understand the relevance of green spaces for health. The second is the opportunity to talk about some of the rich culture of native Brazilians. During the conversation with the students, the teacher mixes the experience of native dances with conversation about their culture and their view of world, body, and health. The third is to give some time for the students to interact, finishing off the morning with a picnic, where each of them brings something along to share.
Fascinating. And why did you choose to teach it outdoors? And what do you think are the benefits of teaching outdoors in this way?
I think it's important when we want to explore the embodied perspective to bring a different experience and stimulate different senses, which is difficult if you always stay inside of your four walls. Also, going outdoors helps them to realize that you can promote health, creating connection with nature and cultural issues.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that you're working with a colleague from the dance program at your university. Can you say something to what you think is like the added value of working with this colleague in the context of this course?
Yes. I think Professor Jair Uman brings a different outlook of the body and movement, pushes the students to move collectively in a very simple way, which creates a strange feeling, but at the same time, it brings a lot of joy and integration between the students. He also works with an understanding of the health of the native Brazilians, which sometimes challenges biomedicine's view of health, a topic we have a more formal discussion about it another class.
Very interesting. And so you've mentioned it briefly already, but what are your students saying about this course? How do they perceive this particular class that you're doing outdoors?
I think they really enjoy it. For a final writing project where they have to talk about three classes from the subject, this morning activities always present because they feel this is an unusual class which helps them to reflect on their interaction with nature, colleagues, the different cultures we have here in Brazil, and how this simple activity makes them feel better. Not only in the end of the class, but for most of them, the rest of the day or even the week.
Yeah, I can see how that is really meaningful. Thank you so much, Adriana. This is really wonderful to hear and gives me lots of inspiration and ideas to think about for myself. One of the interesting things for me, I think also is, you know, based on my own readings around planetary health, is that it's quite widely understood that reconnection to nature or the outdoors is also considered an important action that we need in order to transition as, to a more sustainable future, you know, as humans and as this broader kind of global society. So what you've told me here really fits in well with that and just brings it into physiotherapy education as well. So I actually think I have to go outside now after all this talk about being active outside and feeling and experiencing and connecting to the outdoors with our bodies. Thank you very much for that, Adriana. That was great.
Thank you, Philip.
Hey, Olivia. It's really good to talk to you again. I'm happy we get the chance to do this. Thank you for that. So you're a physiotherapist and a primatologist, and in your current work, you're the acting director of the University of Otago Physiotherapy Clinics in Christchurch on the gorgeous South Island of New Zealand. I suppose that's correct, but could you just tell me a little bit more about what the school clinics usually do and kind of what your work mainly revolves around normally?
So we are a private practice clinic, but we're also open for the students. So we have final year physiotherapy students come through Christchurch, and we have usually blocks of five or six students, and they do a 6 week placement where they work full time. And we do five of those 6 week rotations a year. So about 30 weeks a year, we have students working full time in the clinic.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Thank you. So I know that you've been trying to integrate some environmental and sustainability elements into your work in these school clinics. Could you tell me a little bit about what you've done in this direction so far?
Well, it's actually quite a fun task. One of the first things we did was look at ways that we could try to minimize the paper. So we found some shared drives and we located a lot of our forms and stuff on the server that the staff and the students could access. We've also, the university has moved to a printer system where you have to swipe to get your printing, which has made a big difference with the amount of printing and output that we use. We've done the sort of basic things like in the waiting room where you've got your water cooler and your glasses, we've now made sure that we have like the biodegradable and sustainable paper cups. We've looked at different options as to whether or not things like paper towels versus hand towels were the better way to go, looking at, you know, your cost of your laundry and the products used in the laundering versus the paper towels, and are the paper towels coming from sustainable forestry and that sort of thing. Mm.
I really love that. So let's say you're making some efforts in making the clinic a little bit more environmentally sustainable, right? How does that, like, though doing those kinds of action, how does that feed into the education of the students, like the clinical education of the students? Like, how do you bring those things across to them?
Well, we're actually hoping that we're teaching by example. So basically what I want is the students to see this happening, and I want them to live this clinical experience and then leave believing that this is what is normal and what they should expect for their future.
Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you. So my other question, I suppose, is, or my next question is in light of current events and our current experience of this year, has COVID like put a wrench into this program in any way? Has it created any problems for you? I mean, certainly it's created problems in terms of running the school clinics in the first place, but also with regard specifically to those things that you were doing or that you are exploring to make the clinic more sustainable, has it created any problems there as well?
Yeah, it has a few actually. One of the most obvious ones was our laundry bill. So that changed hugely, and we also had to make sure that the laundry was washed to the correct standards. So the turnover became huge. The other thing we had to do was we sort of had to take the human a little bit out of the rooms. We had to move from having these nice upholstered chairs, comfortable chairs, into these hard plastic surfaces everywhere that were able to be sterilised easily and cleaned easily. We've had to increase the use of hand sanitizers, of course, which, you know, rather than having the less potent version, we've got the full strength stuff. So we're using more chemicals. And our cleaning products, we've got some really, really potent cleaning products now that we're using all of the time. And, you know, that's not without damage, because, for example, if you look at your physiotherapy plinth, we're now using the high alcohol cleaning products, which of course degrades the upholstery. So you've got a higher turnover, and, you know, that's always got a cost. And I mean, an environmental cost as well, reproducing more upholstery and doing all that sort of stuff. So it's been interesting. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, really interesting. Some things that I haven't even thought about actually. You've mentioned quite a few things already, but do you have any other considerations or experiences or ideas that come to mind, maybe as problems to address in the future or as possibilities like to address in the future in order to develop this further?
There's so many. There's one that pops to mind, and that is looking at the environments that we're working in and looking at, again, the human side of it. And a really classic example is, so a lot of our clinical rooms don't actually have windows and they are lit by artificial lighting. And if you have, say, a patient with a cervicogenic headache or something coming in, and the lighting can actually be very, it's a stimulant and it can be glaring and quite uncomfortable. And in those sorts of environments where you don't have the option of having a window, you know, it can be difficult. So I think maybe somewhere for the future would be to look at a more human-friendly environment for us to work in.
Yeah.
Just a thought. Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely a big one. I've experienced that myself, actually. I've worked in some clinics that had where it was standard for the treatment rooms not to have access to natural light. And I found that really, really distressing from a number of perspectives. I know, like, in the year when I was experiencing that, the WHO also put working underground as well as working night shifts, which means, in other words, working away from natural lighting on their list of carcinogens. So this means that we've got a whole bunch of physiotherapists, for example, also in your school clinics, working in spaces that are not very conducive to their own health. So yeah, definitely a really, really exciting and interesting point. So I'm going to, on this note, turn this over to our listeners. And just invite listeners to think about, you know, are they involved, you know, if they are involved in clinical physiotherapy education, does something of what you said resonate with them in terms of, could they apply this in their own clinic or suggest this to the clinical education spaces that they are involved with? Or are there maybe some other ideas? And equally, you know, how does COVID maybe affect what we can do in these spaces? And I would then like listeners to, you know, maybe, yeah, just reflect on this for a moment, take a note of one or two ideas or thoughts that come to mind and bring it back to our discussions. Thanks again, Olivia. So for this last section of this environmental physiotherapy education podcast, I'm just going to briefly talk to you about the Environmental Physiotherapy Agenda 2023. This is a project that we launched from within the Environmental Physiotherapy Association in the beginning of March this year. And it came together as a result of two elements. One was that we've had a lot of students and still do have a lot of students joining our association with a clear desire and really sort of a passion to learn something about how their future profession relates to environmental issues, how they might be able to integrate environmental responsibilities into their, you know, self-understanding as future professional physiotherapists, and how they could maybe do something in the future in this regard. The other element was that we clearly recognize that these are urgent issues, and their health impacts are already extremely dire, and this is likely to progress. So we really felt that there's no time to waste here. It would be good to do something. And specifically, we thought that changing education is probably the most effective and action that we can take, and also the action with the longest lasting effect, in order to ensure that, you know, we can contribute as a profession to the health of future generations and support the transition to a more sustainable, environmentally responsible future. So the agenda really, in the shortest way, has two parts. First of all, it's a call to action aiming at the integration of planetary health, environmental and sustainability perspectives into entry-level physiotherapy education programs around the world. Thankfully, at this point, and despite, or you know, even in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, over a dozen participating institutions have already joined this call and have committed to doing something in this regard over the next now 3.5 remaining years. We've got universities and schools from across New Zealand, Australia, Germany, Chile, the UK, Ireland, USA, Greece, and South Africa on board. And we've got a dozen supporting organizations that have also signed the agenda. And these include national professional organizations, for example, from Sweden, but also from Germany and from New Zealand. We also have student organizations, physiotherapy student organizations specifically, that have expressed their clear support for this agenda, as well as some organizations from outside of physiotherapy and sort of reaching further into sustainable healthcare or planetary health, and some of those other allied parallel projects that we're seeing in the healthcare professions today. And I should say also that we have over 200 individual signatories that have also expressed their support, and these signatures just represent the breadth of people that are recognizing the importance of such change in physiotherapy education. And I'm sure that, you know, we're already in the conversation with lots more universities going, you know, to join, and lots more schools to join, depending, of course, on which country. So we're well underway here already, and this is likely to continue as we go forward. The second part of the agenda is the collaborative development of an environmental physiotherapy education inspiration base. I would say an alternative term for knowledge base, maybe. So we're thinking of something that's open access, online, really transparent, and just some collaborative sharing, so that the focus is not on who does, you know, environmental physiotherapy education better or more or this or that, but really to make an effort in as many of us doing it as best as we can, as soon as possible. And also it's about collaboratively generating a really broad diversity of content and approaches to what environmental physiotherapy education could be, and just transparently sharing and developing this with each other as we go forward. So there's a good relationship here between the Environmental Physiotherapy Agenda 2023 and this guided reflection podcast and conference stream. Insofar as I hope that this podcast has delivered a little bit along the lines of what the agenda also is trying to do. So we've touched on a range of topics that could be of interest to environmental physiotherapy education, and touched on a range of ideas regarding teaching methods. Which means that at this point, I think it leaves nothing for me to say, but that I look forward to brainstorming, discussing, and science fictioning the future of environmental physiotherapy education with you in our upcoming synchronous discussion and office hours, as well as our environmental physiotherapy education stream Padlet on the conference Canvas page. Feel free to add as little or as many reflections as you like there, and whichever format you prefer, whether it's written, spoken, video, image, or even if you want to sing something, I promise you, you can be relieved that I won't be singing anything onto our Padlets, but if anyone would like to contribute something along those lines, that would be fantastic. And yeah, I just thank you for listening and going through these motions here with me. I hope you enjoyed some time outdoors while you've been doing that, and I look forward to seeing you very soon.